Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Episode 21. It's our data and we'll cry if we want to.
This Week in Law is brought to you by Audible. For your free audiobook, visit audiblepodcast.com/TWiL. And by GoToMyPC. Wherever you go, access your PC and all of your files, programs, and email remotely with GoToMyPC. For a free trial of this award-winning service, visit GoToMyPC.com/TWiL. And by listeners like you. Thanks so much for your contribution. We couldn't do TWiT without it. We'd like to thank Victor Cajau for help with this podcast. You can listen to Victor's own podcast, The Typical Mac User, at typicalmacuser.com/WordPress.
So I went ahead and hit record there because I don't want to have our listeners miss any of this live coverage from Mardi Gras, courtesy of our guest Jonathan Bailey. This is Denise Howell, and you're joining This Week in Law in Progress. Jonathan, thanks so much for taking time out of Mardi Gras to join us today.
No, I'm glad to be here. It's nice to be able to sit down for a little bit. I'll take the hour's break.
When did Mardi Gras start, and how describe your partaking in the festivities thus far, if you would?
I'm among lawyers, so I feel compelled to plead the fifth instantly. No, Mardi Gras actually started early February as far as the parades rolling. My favorite crew, the crew to view, I think they rolled the six is what I'm wanting to say. So typically there's about a month of parades. It starts in earnest, typically the Friday before, and there's like a Friday night, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, 4-day big event going on, which is pretty much you see parades every day rolling and French Quarter festivities. And for me, typically, I don't actually drink. It's weird. I'm not a big drinker at all. So I just go down, usually sometimes wear a costume. I didn't get time to do one this year. I've been sick. So just go down, see the people in the costumes, roam around, meet people that look interesting, say hi. And, you know, I've met people from all over the world, and I've seen – and you really get a good feel of the politics and what's big on people's minds by going and seeing what people are doing at Mardi Gras.
That's really cool. I mean, I don't really associate Mardi Gras with a lot of political discourse. Can you elaborate on that for us?
There's a lot of political costumes, and it's been that way, especially since Hurricane Katrina, even more so. But this year, there were a lot of people dressed up as the stimulus package, a lot of people wearing suits made of imitation money. That was big. A lot of Monopoly guys doing the bank CEO thing. And there was a lot of people dressed up as the Octomom. One guy had a full octopus costume with a baby in each arm, and another guy.
Oh, my God.
There's a lot of people like carrying eight baby dolls around. One of them had the big Angelina Jolie wax lips on. So you see a lot of that type of social commentary going on.
And I saw Ernie Svensson, one of our other regular panelists on TWiL, saw his photos of the Barkus parade, the dogs dressed up.
Yeah, the Barkus, yeah.
Which looks highly entertaining. Well, to back up for a second for folks who haven't yet met or encountered Jonathan, he writes one of my all-time favorite copyright and IP-related blogs called Plagiarism Today, which if you haven't checked out and you're a fan of this podcast, please immediately get on over there and check it out. And also does the Copyright 2.0 podcast. So we're really happy to have you sort of moonlight over here on TWiL this week.
It's a big honor. I've been a listener of TWiL ever since the first one, actually. So I can actually say I've been there since the beginning.
Cool. And also a newcomer to TWiL on the line with us today is one of my very old friends on the internet, Rick Clow. Rick, so good to have you on the show finally.
Thanks, Denise. It's great to finally be here.
So Rick, again, for anyone who has not encountered him, is an attorney. He's sort of a recovering attorney, I'd have to say, these days, because his current job is product manager for Blogger at Google. which is...
Right. I'd like to think I've fully recovered since I never actually practiced. I think most of the recovery was done by the time I got the degree.
That's cool. Rick was one of the first people with a law degree that I encountered when I first started blogging oh so many years ago, sometime during the last century. And actually, that's not quite true. I started blogging in 2001. It only felt like it was the last century.
It was within the last 100 years.
That's true, definitely.
That's true. And, well, in blogging terms, that is almost a century. I mean, think about it.
I know. I'm feeling quite dinosaurish these days. And my blogger blog, definitely, Rick and I were discussing the other day, there are some crusty back-end parts of my blog because it's been on the Blogger system since, you know, not too long after Blogger fired itself up.
No, we think of it as special.
I think of it as special,
not
too.
Crusty, special.
Yes. An antique, as it were.
Nostalgic.
Right. Well, I was just remembering today that you and Ernie Svensson and, of course, the Instapundit were some of the only people in the legal field who were blogging when we all first got started so long ago. And I was remembering that back then, your product, Blogger, didn't actually auto-generate RSS or Atom or any other kind of syndication feed for the blogs. And one of my first encounters with you was when Ernie, I think, let me know that you had somehow hacked together an RSS feed for my site, which I was eternally grateful for.
I had completely forgotten about that. That's right. I can't even begin to remember how I did it at the time. But yeah, that's right. Because we started a group blog, you, Ernie, me. There were a handful of others in there, I think.
And, right.
Yeah, we needed a feed from you in order to make it work. And somehow we figured it out.
Right. I remember that group blog. It was called Radio for Lawyers. Right. That's when Radio Userland was, I think, probably the very first popularly available blogging platform. And we were out there trying to show people how to use it. Of course, I wasn't using it at the time.
Right. I had started on Blogger, and then I had talked to John Robb a couple of times. And because I have ADD when it comes to technology, I decided I wanted to give another product a try. And so I played with radio for a while.
So thank you so much for coming down the mists of time to join us here today on 12 via a few notable side turns in your own career and activities. I remember too how involved you were with the Dean campaign and, you know, getting them the internet presence that really was a hallmark of what they did during their campaign.
Certainly ironic given my current job, but the first thing I did for the Dean campaign was convert them off of Blogger onto Movable Type so that we could get comments for the campaign.
Right.
So I admitted to that somewhat cautiously when I was interviewing for this role at Google.
Right. Did you, I'm glad they didn't hold it against you. Didn't you work with Joe Trippi to get that all set up?
I did. In fact, we launched the Movable Type blog and surprised Joe. He had no idea it was happening, and we launched it on his birthday. Which was, rumor has it, one of the few days he was genuinely happy during the campaign. Joe lives in this world where he's perpetually managing a number of fires, and he's a pretty active and energetic guy. But he was pretty thrilled when we managed to get that thing live.
And then you were one of the first people I knew on the web and was following on the web who mentioned the name Obama. Way back, I think, even before he spoke at the convention.
Yeah, I, you're going to make me start sounding like I actually know what I'm doing.
Uh-huh.
I'm trying to think back in late 03, early 04, when he was running for Senate in Illinois. After the Dean campaign blew up, I ended up kind of turning my attentions a little bit more local and ended up running his campaign blog. When he was the Democratic nominee for Senate, running against first Jack Ryan, but then, God bless him, Alan Keyes. So I ran the campaign blog and managed that for a number of months, both before and after the convention speech. And was pretty excited. We knew he was going to go further than the position he was running for at the time.
Well, we in California are happy to have been able to pry you out of the Illinois region and transplant you to, turns out you're living very close to where I grew up in the East Bay area up north. So it's great to have you.
And I tell you what, it's just not been the same in Illinois since Rick left. And, you know, Rick, I drove by your old house the other day, and there's a little, you know, bronze placard out front that said, Obama noshed here. What was that all about?
That's Evan Brown, also on the call with us. Thank you so much, Evan, for coming back to the show.
It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
That's right. Let's see. I mentioned Jonathan's blog, which is plagiarismtoday.com. You can find Rick at rclow.com/tins. T-I-N-S, which has been your blog since the cooling of the earth, as we were discussing, Rick.
Indeed.
Evan is at internetcases.com, and also with us is Colette Vogel at vogellaw.com. Thanks for coming back, Colette.
Hi, Denise. It's great to be back. Hi, everyone.
It's great to have you. So let's see. Oh, just to round out Rick's history before joining us today here on the podcast, you also were you one of the co-founders or just one of the early days people at FeedBurner when it got going?
I was one of the early guys at FeedBurner. I joined after Dick and the founders raised their B round of funding. And I came on to run the publisher services team at FeedBurner, ran that for about 2.5 years before the acquisition by Google.
Right. And then I think the last time you and I saw each other in person was probably at the Portable Media Expo when you were there for FeedBurner.
Yeah, that's right. It was there. And then I think we also ran into each other at one of the Gnomedexes, but I never remember in which order they were.
Yeah, no, Gnomedex was vastly before, I think, at least a couple of years. The one I went to anyway, they have it every year. And a wonderful event it is, but my travels to Seattle were limited to when my child was small enough to sort of put in one location and be confident that he was going to be there with a nanny when I got back. He's since gotten much more mobile than that. So it's great to have you all on the show. I have a bunch of stuff that I'm so excited to pick all of your brains about, given your respective backgrounds and expertises. Rick, you were just mentioning that Larry Lessig spoke at Google a couple days ago. You want to fill us in on that?
Yeah, he was here talking about Change Congress predominantly and the initiative he's got to try and effectively remove the corrupting influence of contributions in the political process. So he was here, spoke for an hour, took a bunch of questions and gave a terrific presentation of what it is he's trying to accomplish with Change Congress. And then afterwards had a lunch with a number of us from a couple of products, people on the legal team, to just try and get a better understanding of how can we as individuals or we as Google help and better understand what it is he's looking to do and how we can make progress in that regard.
Is he pretty much, when he comes and talks about these things, do people still pick his brain on copyright-related issues, or is his focus much more in the political arena these days?
I think it's certainly where his focus is on the congressional side. Clearly, he is well-known in these halls for several of his books and his efforts at both Creative Commons, having sat on the board of EFF and other endeavors. So I think there was quite a bit of interest across the spectrum of cookie jars he's had his hand in the past. But it's clear his passion right now. He, as you may recall, had briefly thought about running for Congress here in California before deciding that he could do more from the outside than from the inside. He really wants to bring as much awareness to this notion of reforming the fundraising model for how people run for Congress. It's a hard problem to solve. I mean, you've got a lot of people who are very invested in the current model continuing in its current form.
I held out some hope, that he would go further with his congressional bid. It's too bad that didn't pan out for him, and B, that he might somehow get involved in the current administration, and we haven't seen that happen yet. But, you know, from time to time, I do see him, even though it does seem his emphasis is on change Congress these days, you know, giving us his insights on the copyright and copyright reform and realities of copyright today, sort of issues. And we have something in our show notes called Fighting IP Extremism with Online Video, where he gives a great interview about remixing online video and how we have to create an environment that takes into account the realism of what is going to happen in that arena and the realism of, or I guess maybe the unrealism of going after people who might have a couple of clips of audio or something playing behind their kid in the video, which gets millions of views. What I'm really interested in that relates to is the fact that shortly after he gave this interview, YouTube announced that it was going to start testing Creative Commons licenses for its videos and started taking requests for people who were interested in applying Creative Commons licensing to the videos. Rick, is this something that has been on your radar at all at Google?
I've been, as you might imagine, 6-8 weeks into the job at Blogger, pretty heads down trying to make sure I have a good sense of what's going on within Blogger. I know the team at YouTube very well. I saw the announcement you're talking about, and I think there was a form to fill out that you can basically apply to have your videos put into the beta program. The specifics or the mechanics behind it, unfortunately, are just not something I've had time to really get up to speed on.
It's something that seems to me, you know, has been a long time coming as far as any sort of user-submitted content kind of site, and YouTube being, you know, one of the primary examples of that and one of the oldest and biggest and most respected, most known examples of that. So it's good to see them publicly coming out and exploring that option.
There's plenty of reasons why they'd want to. It's a lot more savvy way to grab up content than what Facebook tried to do with some modified terms of service.
Absolutely. And I think all that does really tie together very well, you know, this question of who owns your data and who sets the parameters for what happens with user data, that should all flow from the user side much more than it should from the site side. So it's nice to see some more control being given to the users.
Well, one thing that was always interesting about YouTube is there's been a bunch of, I guess you would call them hacky ways to download YouTube clips. And it's nice to see that, A, codified in a way that users don't have to, you know, break the system, so to speak. Also a way that, as you point out, the people who are uploading the videos can control and have some expression of their rights.
Hey, Jonathan, yeah, you raise a really good point that in addition to testing this Creative Commons licensing option, that YouTube has already rolled out the ability to download their videos, which has never before been the case, as you say, without being able to sort of hack your way around that. Can you describe that process for us a little bit and give us your thoughts?
You're talking about the old way to do it or the new way now?
Well, I was talking about the new way, but...
Okay, the new way is certain videos, and I think they are starting somewhat paired up with the CC element. A little pop-up, like an ad, will come up. Like sometimes with YouTube clips, you'll see the ad across the bottom quarter of the video. Well, this will pop up, and it'll offer you to download the video. Sometimes it'll charge 99 cents, and other times it's just an offer that you can download it. I've seen in some cases where you can just simply download it and have it as an MP4. But it also gets it out of that annoying FLV format that only certain players can access right now, so it makes it much more accessible too.
So it sounds like you before, what were you able to do?
There was a bunch of Firefox extensions that would take, there were sites also you could put in the URL of the YouTube clip, and it would convert it to an FLV file you can download. And FLV is the actual file that the YouTube Flash thing is streaming. and it would download that to your computer. And there are some movie players that can do FLV. I don't think Windows Media Player can, but I know VLC Player can. And there's a bunch of specific players for FLV files. But yeah, it was you had to get either Firefox extension or use third-party sites that were kind of, I guess you would say, tap dancing a little bit with the Facebook terms of service.
Right. So now what you're saying is that some of the videos have this option and some do not?
Yeah. Right now, not every video is downloadable, but some are. And there's a lot of, we're seeing a lot of it, like music videos are being made available for download for pay. You pay the 99 cents or $2 or whatever they're charging right now. I'm not exactly sure what the exact price is on these things, but you pay that and you download. And there's some videos that you can download for free. So it is.
So this is this is one way Google is starting to compete a bit with iTunes.
Exactly. I think they're starting to also turn this into a revenue model for YouTube, which is something, of course, they've been very desperately seeking since day one.
Right. Well, that's all good news and certainly something to watch as we go forward. This Creative Commons piece continues to be, Evan, as you said, it's something that I think is critical to bear in mind as we figure out our way through what happens to user data on sites such as Facebook and Twitter and Flickr. Flickr, of course, has had Creative Commons built in, baked in for a very long time and now has tens of millions of Creative Commons licensed works. But I think something that doesn't come up that often is how important it is to make sure the rights to reuse user-submitted works are clear when sites are going to have open APIs like Flickr does and like Twitter does. Twitter, I've noticed, has not had any baked-in Creative Commons licensing, although in their terms of service, they put in this little nod to, we encourage you to freely license your material that you put on Twitter. Twitter also has a really nice, in stark contrast to Facebook, which I do want to get to talking about in a few minutes here, a really nice approach to who owns and controls user-submitted content. Twitter pretty much takes a completely hands-off approach on that front and encourages users to license their stuff for easy reuse. But they don't provide any baked-in method for doing this. But a few people, you know, as I was grousing about that on Twitter last week, immediately tweeted back to me that, hey, have you seen this TweetCC thing? Have you guys seen this yet?
I saw it in the show links and was trying to get my head around how you would actually use it.
Right. It does seem a little bit sort of bootstrapped on after the fact.
Yeah, it's a hack. There's no doubt.
But Jonathan, you've played with it, I think. Didn't you license your tweets?
Yeah, I went ahead and used it. And I wrote about it, too. Basically, what you do is you visit the tweet.cc site, and I think it's tweetcc.com is all that it is. Basically, if you're logged into Twitter when you're there, you go to its license page, and it gives you, I think it's CC0, which is the new answer to the CC public domain license. They've now switched to CC0 all the way to the NCND, you know, by NCND license, all sorts of Creative Commons. You pick the license that you want. You hit the button, and it'll pull up your Twitter account with a specially formatted tweet preloaded. It @replies TweetCC, and it has the text in it related to the license that you want. You just simply hit submit, and TweetCC records your Creative Commons selection and puts it in their database. And that's pretty much all that it is.
So you're giving notice once in your stream of tweets. So I don't know. I mean, as a one-time sort of ephemeral thing, someone comes along months later and wants to use one of your tweets, they're not necessarily going to know that any of them are licensed.
Yeah. Well, one idea I kicked around with them when I was emailing back and forth learning about it was maybe, because there's all these wonderful Twitter background generators, perhaps some way to integrate with that to add the licensing to the background as well. That way it'd be clearly displayed to anyone that visited your Twitter page at the very least.
That would kind of eliminate the need for the service, though, wouldn't it? I mean, all you have to do is just throw up a JPEG as your, as background that you want, kind of roll them out of the picture, wouldn't it?
Well, there's also the RSS feed, right? Everybody's Twitter stream has an associated RSS feed, and you can't touch that or edit it unless you run it through
Gary Paltz.
You could run it through Feedburner, right?
Well, you could, although I guess I forget what the stats are specific to Twitter, but I mean, I know I visit all of my tweets come to me through TweetDeck. I rarely go back to Twitter.com, and I'm not subscribed to anyone's Twitter feed via RSS. So the challenge I had, as much as anything, to Denise's point, is simply discoverability. If I don't have an easy way of seeing that something is in fact licensed, then it strikes me that it's hard to know. You know, the best use case would be someone is searching for something specific that they want to know that someone said. So you go to search.twitter.com, you punch in the query, you find the tweet from the individual in question. There is no point at which it surfaces that tweet is licensed or not. And so I guess the question is the lack of discoverability preventing anyone from acting on that tweet? I want to know what the licensing allows me as the speaker to do that I can't do otherwise.
Well, you know, let's be pragmatic about this. What conceivable use is there, in reusing? And actually, there's a couple of different issues we need to talk about. Just the first one being, what conceivable use is there for reusing a particular tweet? And the other issue is really, does this license attach to particular tweets, or does it attach to the collective work, which is a person's entire Twitter stream?
I think, Evan, thank you so much for bringing that up. And I also think a big issue is, you know, what is the scope of a copyright in a particular tweet? And it's very fact intensive. You know, if you're just reporting a particular fact, you can't really appropriate that through copyright.
Right. So,
yeah, I mean,
Colette, you were just at a copyright seminar where Mary Beth Peters, the head of the U.S. Copyright Office, was speaking, and it was fun because Evan and I were tweeting at you and you were tweeting at us about this issue, and you said you were going to try and slip in a question to her. Did that manage to happen?
No, it didn't, unfortunately, but it was so funny because we were talking about this copyrightability of a snippet of something, and that issue came up actually a few times on Friday, but in one context was what she had been talking about at that time, and it would have been nice to be able to slip in a question. But there is sort of a general principle that short words and phrases and slogans are not protectable by copyright. That's the realm of trademark. And yeah, 140 characters certainly, I think, could have some creativity in it, though, by all means, but it's so context specific. And, you know, if you're a poet and that's your livelihood is writing poetry, and you decide I'm going to write a Twitter poem and it's going to be 140 character clauses, you know, yeah, maybe there should be some copyright in the overall poem. But if somebody takes a snippet of it and does something with it, yeah, we need think about what they're doing and if it's possibly infringing. But I think the chances are much less likely that they are in most instances. So,
but really, what is the anticipated use of this? I mean, what is it that people are envisioning others doing with their Twitter content? I'll just say it generally, when they slap a creative content or Creative Commons license on it.
Well, aggregation's the thing that mostly occurs to me. And unlike with blogs, tweets are short enough so that you could, you know, readily aggregate the whole thing. They also lack headlines so that if you're just aggregating the first three words or so, that's not going to provide any value or meaning for people who are reading the aggregated work. So I could definitely see, since Twitter is this vast undifferentiated universe of information, someone coming along and imposing. Well, for example, I don't know, you guys have probably all seen Lex Tweet. I don't know how many of our listeners would be interested in that, but if you go to lextweet.com/tweeters, there's a list of several thousand legal types who are on Twitter. So LexBlog, which is the sponsor of that, Kevin O'Keefe's been on the show before, is attempting to impose some sort of vertical interest categorization organization on Twitter and is aggregating at least the tweeters there. So you could see someone going the extra step. And I have definitely seen someone like Justicia, I think, is aggregating the tweets, but people have to actively enroll to be included in that service.
I mean, I guess this belies my technology bent since getting my law degree, but this seems to me like a legal solution in search of a problem. And it feels like something that's going to need to be more of a technical solution when the problem arises. So I can see situations that are going to develop over time where it could be aggregation of tweets that are undesirable for whatever reason, whether it's someone with whom you disagree that is misrepresenting the origin of the statement or attributing to you content you didn't in fact create, that you can see how that could develop over time. I don't know that there are any examples of that today. If there are, I would assume they are edge cases. But that when the need does arrive, this is going to be something that is going to be handled better mechanically, right? So whether it is some metadata that's included in the RSS feed or becomes one of the parameters in an API call to say to Twitter, only give me tweets that have been licensed with the following tag, that's going to have a much higher likelihood of success, I would think, than the current approach, which is, I think, difficult to discover and not mechanically useful. I think one of the things that has driven Creative Commons usage and its wide adoption is the fact that computers can read the Creative Commons license and act accordingly. So you can filter search results according to a license. You can publish a page or include a page according to the manner in which it was licensed. I think in this mechanism, that seems like there's a big enough gap that it's not likely to solve a big problem.
Right. Well, and in that scenario, Twitter has to jump in here and not just be an active or a passive person on the sideline saying, we encourage you to license your tweets. They would have to be able to enable that API call that you described.
Yeah, or you'd need a middleman, right? Someone who would say, I will be a proxy through which you can make an API call and I can add in the licensing data. But if you wanted to be that middleman, you would need pretty significant scale. And you'd need to set the expectation that, it was advantageous to you to use them instead of going to Twitter directly.
So I think this is the copyright issues are super interesting, but I think Twitter also has a lot of reputation and sort of affiliation related issues that could arise that are also legal concerns. And I wonder, in all of this aggregation and all, whatever is going to happen in the world of Twittering, which is really fun. I can't say that I actually really have enjoyed sort of playing around with it the last few months. But what does it say? Like, how does one hold on to reputation related issues that aren't, copyright specific, but that is, someone taking something I say out of context or putting, aggregating it in a site that I don't want to be affiliated with. And now my name is is associated with that. Is that all upon the user not to do that or to not be part of a public timeline or to not allow certain people to follow them? I'm just curious if that's been blogged about or talked about much. I know that the copyright question has been on the radar of a few people more recently, but I'm curious about these other issues too.
It would seem that if you're going to license your Twitter content out there with, for example, the least restrictive license, which as I understand is just merely provide attribution, correct? And maybe
no. Well, you could make it public domain.
They've actually got CC0, and public domain license.
Okay, fine, but that's not really a license. That's an abandonment. It's no longer subject to intellectual property rights to license. So, I mean, among the actual real licenses, there's you're just saying at least provide me with attribution. So you are authorizing the users to, for example, make derivative works. So it seems like you would just be inviting people to, those who desired to defame you, because they could always add in words to your Twitter content that make you sound, say the exact opposite of what you are. And you really have no recourse against them, in terms of copyright. I just don't see what the advantage is. And it makes me want to comment, you know, to Rick, what you said. That's very well put when you said this is a legal solution that's looking for some kind of technical problem. I just can't conceive of really what the point is here.
Well,
I'm trying my best not to sound like a Luddite.
Well, I'll say the reason I went ahead and did it, which was I license everything plagiarism today related under a Creative Commons by share alike license. And it was just easier for me personally to say people everything related to PTs under this license, here you go, than it is to try to differentiate between Twitter and various things. Even if it doesn't have any real meaning, it simplifies things to me to have all my content under the unified license, including Twitter. It's more of a personal simplicity than necessarily solving a problem about use of my Twitter content.
Well, answer me this. You know, I know that you're really focused on content theft and people and you know, protecting your rights on that. Say that you come to regret the decision of licensing your Twitter content under this Creative Commons license, and because you see that somebody is essentially ripping your Twitter stream off and republishing it in a way that you don't want them to, but yet not violating that copyright license. Jonathan, you have granted a license. Mm-hmm. That is irrevocable. What are you going to do in that situation where things go south?
Well, one thing is you can always remove the license on future works.
Wait. Okay, I don't want to interrupt you, but what is the work that you've licensed? If it's your Twitter stream, then that collective work is constantly developing. It's one work that you have licensed.
I think I was going to go back to that point because I think
you could undo it.
Yeah,
CC right now lets you change the license. One of the gripes I had with it is that there is no way right now to designate all rights reserved. That's one of the really big gripes I had with it, because it has the whole range of CC licenses but no all rights reserved license. And that's one of the things that does make me worry and a little nervous. There should be a way to do that. And if you change your license, it records the change. So,
but an all rights reserved license is not a license. It's just copyright.
That's true. But something to indicate that you do not, you know, wish to have your tweets used. Something to say no and to go back on a Creative Commons license if you change your mind. Some way to indicate that.
I thought that Creative Commons licenses were irrevocable.
Evan, you're right, but they're irrevocable for the works past. You can apply a new CC license or no license and just reserve all rights going forward. It's just you can't go back and undo the ones that people have relied on. It's just from a practical standpoint impossible to go do that.
Right.
If you changed your blog from tomorrow, you decided to start having your blog be under an all rights reserved model, you know, all of your posts going forward would be under that model.
But can't my blog and, you know, correspondingly my Twitter stream be considered one collective work?
It can, but I think
and it's already been licensed.
The model that's been applied to blogging, and if you look at the Flickr model too, it is the work
individual
at that particular time. Yeah, not the future works. I don't know. I don't think that's ever been tested in court, and it's a good question.
It is a good question, I guess.
Yeah, it definitely hasn't been tested. But I think, Evan, I can see that you might – your blog as a whole – there's an argument that's a collective work. I think with Twitter though, yeah, Denise, every time you upload, you can change.
With Flickr, you mean?
Yeah, I'm sorry, with Flickr, yes.
Yeah, but the Flickr, it's clear what there are discrete works. You know, like the photo is much more of a discrete work.
Than a blog entry?
Collections and albums and put them in groups. And some of the items in each group may or may not be all rights reserved.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you know what? I mean, this is a bit straying afield. And Colette, I want to get back to this question of whether and when a tweet would be copyrightable at all, because I think that's an interesting thing to look at. But as long as we're talking about Flickr, one thing that has really fascinated me there is they've got this whole very detailed Creative Commons licensing scheme going on, and there are tens of millions of works. But they also have Blog This. Has anyone paid close attention to this?
Mm-hmm.
Blog This is it's about a two-word license that basically when you are setting up the settings for your account, I think, you know, when you first open up your Flickr account, and maybe if you go in to tweak the settings after that, you'd notice this, that you have the ability to tell the Flickr community and the world that it's okay for, even if you haven't applied any sort of Creative Commons license to a photograph or a group of photographs, that it's okay to blog them. And what that means is two things, as far as I could tell. Number one, that it can go out, as Rick was saying before, in an API call to a site like Plinky, for example, Jason Schellen's new site at plinky.com, and a whole other sites that make calls on the Flickr API to haul in pictures. Now, Plinky is an interesting example because it's a blogging platform. It allows you to publish to the Plinky community and also to publish on your blog, wherever that may be. So you're taking advantage of this blog this permission that's been put into Flickr, not any of the Creative Commons licenses, but simply the permission to let other people blog your works. And the works go out of Flickr and into other people's works through that mechanism. And that strikes me as really interesting to keep an eye on and look at, because I think there might be a disconnect between what the users expect and what's actually happening. Anybody have any thoughts on that?
I sure do. I would suggest that you don't even need that you wouldn't even need that two-word license in order to put a Flickr photo on your blog, because you're really not exercising any of the rights of the copyright owner by merely inline linking it. And I would look to the case, like the Perfect 10 case, to say, you know, there's like the server test. It's being served up from the Flickr server in, you know, within the HTML generated by the particular blog. So I'm not even sure that it's necessary to construe that as a license at all. And whether or not the owner of the copyright in the photograph would have much of a cause of action, whether it be for straight up infringement or breach of that two-word license, if you wanted to go ahead and blog a photo on Flickr anyway.
Right. That's an interesting distinction, because you could certainly blog something in one of two ways. The inline linking way, you know, a la embedding a YouTube video, which is something Jonathan and I have talked about in the past, and the downloading way, which is also when you make your photos on Flickr available through this blog this permission, the download permission seems to follow in line with that too, because those are the ones that you can go and see the different sizes of photos and download the different sizes. So you could certainly blog it that way too.
But the blog this function doesn't, I mean, the blog this function just allows you to inline link. Doesn't it just facilitate that? Doesn't it generate some like Ahref tags that send you to a path on the Flickr server? It doesn't download the photo to your local system that you have to upload to your own server and then link that
way. But I do think the inverse is also true, that Flickr and YouTube and other services that are hosting media give the content owner the ability to restrict the embedding or the referencing of the image in the case of an image.
Yes.
So that they can protect their work from being incorporated if they don't want it to be. So I would kind of suggest, along the lines of what Evan is saying, that in this case, there is a legal facilitation at work, but there's also a technical one, which is if you don't want this stuff distributed, it's very easy to incorporate these functions to prevent it from being distributed.
And you could still inline link a Flickr photo without the blog this capability. You could, you know, ascertain what the URL, you know, what the file path is, and go ahead and dump that into your post.
Although if as the content owner you've turned off that ability, Flickr at the server level can restrict the serving up of that image on domains other than Flickr.
Are we talking about the turning off the ability to download or the functionality of this blog this button? Because I thought you could turn off this blog this button, but while still permitting others to download the full size image.
I'm not certain about that. I'm not sure if those are separate ticks on their permissions categories or not. They might be. Yeah, somebody look at that, because it seems to me that they tend to go hand in hand, and I don't know whether that's because of the disposition of the users who, you know, somebody who's inclined to permit one would be inclined to permit the other, or if Flickr has in its wisdom decided that these things go hand in hand. But anyway, we're kind of getting down a copyright rat hole there on that particular issue. I just think it's really interesting because with this whole Creative Commons infrastructure baked into the site, the blog this thing is something that I get questions about all the time. What does this mean? And why are my pictures showing up on other people's sites? And I haven't licensed anything, and yet people can use this. Okay, Colette, you were saying there's a separate toggle for downloading and blogging?
Yeah, so under privacy and permissions, there's about five items down under your global settings. It says who can blog your stuff. And the options are only you, you and your family, you and your friends, you, your family and your friends, you and any of your contacts, or finally, any Flickr member. So you have to be a Flickr member at minimum to have that button pop up. But
is there no way to block Evan?
No way to just block Evan.
I'm going to be blogging all your stuff.
Well, that's really interesting, because when you go in and you read the Flickr FAQ help information, they extend it not just to, you know, people being Flickr members as the possible outer universe, but they go ahead and clarify that, hey, oh, by the way, your stuff is available to through our API too. So that's something that wouldn't be transparent to users until they went to that FAQ page, because they were surprised when they saw their image show up on somebody's blog via something like Plinky.
Yeah. They do say that the blog this function is only available on public content. So apparently it's not available for things that you have posted as, I guess, just to your friends. I don't know what public content.
Private content, yeah, not in your Flickr stream.
There's private, then for friends and for family.
Okay, so if it's anything but private, I guess I would think it's public then, like even if it's just to your friends and family.
I don't think you could block that based on what you just said. I mean, because it wouldn't show up. I mean, it would be behind the, you know, behind the wall.
Right.
So I want to get to this question about short works like tweets and copyrightability, and also to the disintermediating the paparazzi question as celebrities like Ashton Kutcher and Demi Moore come on to Twitter. But first, we need to take a little break and thank our sponsor, GoToMyPC, which I'm sure some of you folks have probably either used GoToMyPC or their enterprise product, Citrix. This was a mainstay of a couple of the law firms that I've worked at. And GoToMyPC works pretty much exactly like Citrix. It allows you to access a computer remotely from anywhere in the world, be it your home or traveling abroad. And the traveling abroad point is key, because when you're accessing through GoToMyPC, it's a very secure connection. It doesn't matter where you are in the world. When you're accessing your computer remotely via GoToMyPC, you are doing it in a secure and safe way, which is important to the lawyers on the phone and in addition to everybody else out there. So if you go to mypc/twill, you have the ability to try this wonderful service for 30 days free. I find it very, very useful, both for my own computers when I'm traveling and also for family, since I live so far away from a lot of our family. And yet sometimes I'm the default technical support. I'm able to go ahead and access their computers remotely and help them out that way a bit. So please go check out GoToMyPC/Twill. Do your 30-day trial. Let us know what you think. And we thank them for being a sponsor of Twill. So, Colette, give us your thoughts on the copyrightability of an individual tweet.
Well, I think it, you know, it's very case specific, but I think that the chances of it, you know, you having enough, meeting the threshold for originality, which isn't very high, but depending on what you're tweeting about, I think it's very unlikely that an individual tweet is going to qualify in and of itself for broad copyright protection.
Why don't we start from square one and let people know what the standard is to begin with?
Right. So the standard was actually announced. I mean, it's in the Copyright Act, but also fleshed out in the Feist case at the Supreme Court, where the court basically said the modicum of originality that you need for copyright protection is fairly low. But the things that we know that are clearly not protectable are statement, you know, factual information. So, you know, if you're thinking about copyright outside of Twitter, we think about a news article. The overall article and the use, the words and the order in which they appear and structure and everything could be protected under copyright. But the facts that underlie that article are not protected. So if you think about Twitter, a lot of the stream of what people are writing about is, oh, I just, you know, it's raining today and it's really depressing me, or I just saw this great thing on CNN, go over here, or, you know, those are the, at least from my limited experience, you know, of the 100 or so odd people that I follow, that's a lot of what's being reported in these little 140 character statements. And so I think a lot of that is just unprotectable factual pieces of information that don't have a lot of ways to say them and don't include a lot of originality. And that's not to say there isn't certain tweets where you're like, that was really clever or funny, or the way that person really captured that moment was unique or you know, creative. That's not to say that that's not happening. It's just that I think the protection you're going to get for that individual tweet is so limited. I don't know what someone's going to do in the long run, other than maybe publish a book of poetry, for example, of their Twitter poems. You know, I could see someone doing something creative like that. But in an individual post, I'm curious what other people think on the panel, but I think that that's pretty minimal.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not ready to come down one way or the other on it, actually, but I understand what you're saying. One of the things that I like to think about when I think about creative tweets is this offshoot of the textism site called Favored. Have you guys checked this out? Which is a very subjective compilation of what somebody thinks are the most clever tweets coming through the system, and they are hysterical, a lot of them. And if someone were to try and do that and then stick a bunch of ads or other content next to them that the tweeters did not approve of or want to be associated with or did not want to, you know, be the driving content engine of somebody else's business, then I could see them, particularly when the tweets are so very creative as the ones that are on this favored site, I could see them deciding to try and push that issue.
Right. You can go there or just go to, you know, Scott Simpson on Twitter. I know, Rick, you're a fan of his, right?
He is the funniest man on Twitter, and he is criminally underused at Apple Computer.
Let me read this, and you tell me this isn't protectable by copyright. This is a tweet he put up on February 19th at 1:39 p.m. Says, I think it was a typical Atlanta lunch. Steak, smothered in gravy, drowned in cheese, strangled by onions, and pistol whipped with butter. I mean, I once, you know, as proof of concept, saw if, you know, William Carlos Williams' Red Wheelbarrow would fit in 140 characters, and it does. And I don't think anybody's going to say that William Carlos Williams' poetry is not copyrightable, but, you know, gosh, we've got this stuff. That proves it without even having to resort to, you know, 20th century poetry.
Yeah, absolutely.
There is a very large haiku movement on Twitter. And there actually is a Twitter bot that has been republishing all of the haiku poems. I can't remember the account name off the top of my head. I think it's like Haiku, T-W-I-Q. But there isn't, and a lot of these haiku users are very upset because it doesn't follow retweet format and doesn't provide attribution. So that could be one of the potential test cases we see moving down the road on this.
I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, I think the right thing for someone in Twitter's position to do is they don't want to be the arbiter of who can or can't do things with the tweets. They have succeeded wildly by kind of defaulting to public in much the same way that Flickr did. I wouldn't be surprised, however, to see conditions placed on the use of the API such that tweets pulled from the API have attribution. You know, this would follow in the model of what Mike Masnick is such a big fan of at TechDirt, where his whole thing is, look, you know, certain things that are given away promote the content owner, the artist, whatever the person behind the content is, in the increased distribution that they get, in the increased audience that they get, in most cases, the aggregation of these tweets is going to accrue new audience to the person who said the thing, so long as it's clear that it came from that person. And I know if I were Scott Simpson, I'd be a hell of a lot funnier than I am now. But I would want to know when I came up with that great line that others knew it came from me. And he's certainly not looking to monetize his tweets, but he is building that audience and monetizing it in other ways.
And with that, I'll say twitter.com/Scott Simpson.
Yeah.
And favored is if you just Google F-A-V-R-D without the E in between, you'll find a whole host of other really fun ones.
I unfortunately have to jump off. Yeah. I'm sorry to cut this short, but I have a meeting I could not move, and I just got word that they are waiting for me downstairs.
Hey, well, it's not like you have a blogging platform to run or anything. We're really excited that you joined us, Rick, and we're going to talk a little bit behind your back after you're gone about bloggers' terms of service, which like Twitter's.
Oh, now we can really get to
it. Now I see the plot. Now it becomes clear. Well, hey, don't say anything too bad, and I'll listen and follow up separately. But thanks, everybody. It's been a pleasure.
Hey, thank you. And I'm going to plug all your sites when you go offline. Have fun in your meeting.
Thanks, guys.
Okay, bye. Okay. So,
Denise, before we go on, I just want to comment on what was just said before Rick had to take off, but if this is okay. So I'm just wondering about these aggregation things, because I'm not familiar with Favored, so I'm going to go check that out. But what's the claim? I wrote 140-character, really interesting, funny, creative comment about my steak. Scott Simpson's a friend. I like him. I'm not, saying that his steak comment wasn't really great and creative. But what's my claim? I have to go register my copyright in this little snippet, and then I have to accuse Favored of infringing that copyright. They've taken the whole thing. I think there's a good argument that they've repurposed it. There's possibly a very good fair use argument for a company like Favored.
Right. And it's not even a company. I think it's just a person. Yeah. And they're not attaching any advertising or having any kind of commercial use.
But even if they did have a commercial use of it, is this really the copyright, the purpose of our copyright law? I think it's really more about someone's reputation. And I think these issues, this is like one of the first times I'm really kind of figuring this out for myself, is that, I've been seeing tons of reputation related issues happening in the last 2 years, like just exponentially happening. And then I see all this stuff happening with copyright. And I wonder if people are just really like, the reputation now seems so entwined with what they've written and copy, put up on the web and everything, that these things are colliding. Cause I don't see this as a copyright problem as much. I don't know. That's my beef.
But if it's not, you think it's more of a name and likeness, right, of publicity sort of problem?
Yeah, it's like if Favored wants to take Scott Simpson's handle, I'm assuming it's his, what was his name? What is it? I need to follow him.
It's Scott Simpson.
Okay, yeah. So they're going to take his name and put it on their website. Now, if they start monetizing that, I think that he may have a right of publicity claim there. They need permission to publish someone's name in association with what they're doing under California law. So there may be something there that is an issue. And maybe Scott doesn't want to have his tweet in the context of other tweets that this random person thinks is really interesting or funny. Or what if someone wants to opt out of the whole consumerism world and wants to be able to tweet but not have to have everything they do be monetized, and they're anti-consumerists and they don't want to be part of this economy? I mean, is there opportunity then to leave Twitter? Maybe that's the choice they make. But I see it's more about that kind of stuff than it is about is there really truly copyright protection over my creative tweet.
Well, it's good that you'll have at least more than one cause of action.
The copyright one gets you into federal court if you'd like. So.
Right. I don't think the copyright claim is going to go away. I think it'll be interesting to see it tested.
Yeah.
As we know, you don't have to register your copyright in order or each work as a copyrighted work in order for it to be copyrighted. It is by default. But, if you're going to recover damages, that's another
option of doing
a lawsuit. You cannot file a lawsuit registered to work.
Right. But
you can file DMCA notices and take other action, which are in most cases on the internet are probably the default actions.
Right, and send demand letters and.
That's a good point.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
you don't need to, if you're going to invoke the judicial system, that's when you need to have registered things. And that's a whole interesting thing when you get right down to it with blogging as well. Microblogging.
God bless USA.
Yeah. Microblogging isn't unique in that sense because, you know, how many bloggers do you know who are registering their blog with the copyright office in any sort of significant cognizant way?
I know someone who's registering their Twitter feed every 3 months.
That's interesting.
Yeah, well, my clients register their blogs every 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But
I know someone that does Twitter, so there you go.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, but you've got, I mean, what tiny fraction of the minority of users is that?
Right.
Probably just the one.
Yeah.
Well, and the guys who are serious, you know, yeah. Obviously not, but yeah, you know, Colette, you're making a really interesting point there where this all, you know, there's this great overlap between the different, you know, forms of intellectual property, really. I mean, with the copyright and with the right of publicity issue as far as that pertains to publicity. And Denise, I don't know if you were going to bring it up later with, you know, talking about the new Associated Press case, you know, with the hot news, you know, the misappropriation of hot news case that just came out last week. I mean, there's this whole notion of kind of an unfair competition, depending on what the content is. If it was a news source like, you know, CNN or something like that, who was actually breaking news through their Twitter feed, it's possible that that could even be another, you know, state-based cause of action for misappropriation. You know, this notion of the protection of the hot news,
right?
As well, now, as the copyright and right of publicity and all that stuff.
I think that's an excellent point. Why don't you elaborate on that case and bring our listeners up to speed as to what has happened?
Well, it was last week. It was a case called the Associated Press versus All Headline News Corp. It came out of the federal court, the Southern District of New York, and essentially. The Associated Press, that we all know, has been around for eons, is a news gathering source, and it distributes the breaking news to its to a number of different types of recipients. Well, it filed suit against All Headline News Corp, which essentially ran a website that, in so many words, it's alleged that they just repurposed AP content and resold it, and. Often without attributing the Associated Press. And so AP filed a lawsuit alleging a number of causes of action, misappropriation of the hot news, which, you know, is, as we learned in the case now, is based on New York state law, copyright infringement. There were some Lanham Act, you know, unfair competition, you know, federal level unfair competition claims. There was a claim under the DMCA at Section 1202, which is kind of a section of the DMCA you don't see very much, but it was alleging wrongful removal of copyright management information. Then there was also a state-based unfair competition claim. But I think the most interesting part of the case really is the holding or the portion dealing with the misappropriation of hot news. The defendants, you know, this website operator, these website operators filed a motion to dismiss under 12b-6, which, as the lawyers listening know, tests merely the sufficiency of the pleadings. It's not an evaluation of the facts or a determination of really who's right or who's wrong ultimately, but it's just testing whether or not the AP, sufficiently pled a cause of action for misappropriating the hot news.
Right, which, in other words, means can we have a lawsuit about this or not?
Right, exactly. So, I mean, even though the AP won this portion of the case, the claim for misappropriation of hot news was not dismissed. It doesn't mean that they've ultimately won the case, and it doesn't mean that there was an appropriate misappropriation of hot news. But essentially, what we learned from the case is that it can go forward, saying that that the AP has adequately pled that this is a misappropriation of the AP's right to be really exclusive, the exclusive distributor of this breaking news that they have, incurred great expense to go out and gather and distribute. So the interesting thing for us to talk about, I think, or at least the interesting things that I've been thinking about, is how this relates to copyright and how it really provides an extra cause of action that really is based on something that copyright law does not recognize, namely the sweat of the brow. So it's interesting because it's kind of like this little phantom cause of action out here that doesn't come up all that often, but it really provides a valuable set of remedies when you think they otherwise may not exist.
So let's tie that in with our Twitter example. Let's say that the AP is breaking hot news on its Twitter account and someone is RTing it immediately, as often happens.
Yes.
Are you saying that AP would conceivably have a cause of action against people who immediately pick that up and rerun it?
Well, there's several elements of the of the cause of action that the case actually talks about. It breaks out those elements from another federal case from about 10 years or so ago dealing with sports scores. And I know, Jonathan, you wrote about this case in quite a bit of depth, so I hope you can add some insight into it as well. But essentially, the elements are, among the elements are that the plaintiff, in this case the AP, gathered the, or you're talking about, in a Twitter feed being, the tweets being immediately retweeted. You'd have to show that news was actually gathered at great cost, and that there's free writing going on, and that it reduces the incentive for the original news gatherer to go out and do that, because it's just being put out there with nothing, nothing really, with no effort going on. So the thing is, if it's a situation where there is breaking news being put out there, and it's the person who's gone and actually found it, there's this extra way of getting that stopped in addition to a potential action for copyright infringement. And it's something that's extra in addition to that. But
that doctrine just makes so little sense to me in today's world.
Yeah.
Say you're the person on the ferry in the Hudson who sees the plane crash, and you're sending your picture from your camera phone up to Twitter. That's certainly hot news.
Right. I don't think that you'd be misappropriating, the AP or any news gatherer's hot news right there, because one of the elements is that you're free writing.
No. But someone could misappropriate you rather easily. Right. You're the little guy. You're doing the legwork. Today it's not just the AP who could assert that right. I suppose that maybe the little guy wants that right when his picture gets picked up by CNN and everything else, to go ahead and make sure they get compensated for it. Because I suppose there could be scenarios where they might not be.
Well, one thing that is interesting is that the right only lasts as long as the news has commercial value. Now, how long is that in today's news cycle? You tell me. That's almost nothing.
Right. Shorter than it was in 1918 when this
Supreme Court case.
Right.
Hey, yeah, one of the elements is time sensitivity. So, when it becomes not so time sensitive, you've just got the regular copyright laws to.
And then it's a matter of fact, and there you go. Most cases, at least, it'd be a matter of fact. So.
Right.
Denise, one of the reasons I think that this is a little bit unpalatable to us, or at least one of the reasons why it's unpalatable to me, is because it implicates this sweat of the brow doctrine that the Feist case from 1991, expressly did away with. It used to be the theory that if you work really hard and incur expense to gather facts and then distribute those facts, you have a copyright right in that merely because you worked so hard. And Feist, did away with that. By the way, I really love her music, that 1, 2, 3, 4.
Who knew the U.S. Supreme Court could be so high on the pop charts?
And thanks, it's stuck in my head now.
Right, 18 years ago, nonetheless. But, but here we've got the hot news right, the right to have the exclusive right appropriate the hot news. And one of the factors is that you incur great costs and expense to go out and gather it. That's the sweat of the brow doctrine built right into this cause of action that you can still seek recovery for. But it's more under a general notion of unfair competition rather than copyright.
Right.
And well, one thing that irks me is it's going to be very difficult for, I mean, if it's, we're sitting here debating it, you know, an average Twitter user to distinguish between what is simply a fact they can republish and what would be this hot news is going to be very complicated. And it's going to see, it can be very quickly obvious where there could be a large amount of gray area.
Yes, yes. And I think, you know, the news source or news originator like the AP or CNN or Fox News or whatever would have a hard time going after people who are retweeting, you know, willy-nilly. You know, once in a while they'll see an interesting fact, you know, there's been a plane crash on the Hudson, retweet that. Because, you know, another one of the factors is that it has to reduce the incentive of the original news gatherer to go ahead and continue gathering news, which, you know, sounds a lot like one of the fair use factors. You know, it has to, you know, affect the market or whatever, and it may not be a fair use, but it does affect the market. Yeah, but once again, we don't want to confuse copyright too much, but it has kind of that same sensibility here. So, you know, there could be this gray area, but I think there's a reason why we don't see a whole lot of litigation on this cause of action, because it's a difficult one to prove. And, you know, most news organizations like the AP have lawyers who we, you know, have to give the benefit of the doubt, won't file complaints routinely that violate Rule 11.
Yeah. One can only hope. I want to circle back to, you know, since we're tossing out all these potential causes of action that relate to sharing of news and media in a real-time kind of way, I want to circle back to Colette's right of publicity point from a moment ago and talk about the implications of, you know, potentially doing away with the entire paparazzi industry, or at least making their jobs more difficult and more competitive when you get people like Demi Moore and Ashton Kutcher going ahead and putting their own images of themselves out there and their own, you know, insights into their daily lives and activities that, you know, usually they would have to be stalked to come up with. Obviously, people are aware by this time, or maybe not aware, that Demi and Ashton have been using Twitter and rather actively. And they're also using TwitPic, which I think is pretty interesting, and putting up photos of themselves in kind of campy situations.
So it's like they've become their own paparazzi.
Exactly. So yeah. what this reminded me of when I saw this beginning to happen was a few years back when podcasting first came on the scene, and Adam Curry was out there doing it and using various kinds of social media, including Flickr, and putting pictures of himself and his wife, the lovely Patricia, online, and his family. And he had a whole lawsuit about use of his, I believe, Creative Commons licensed Flickr photos that were not licensed for commercial use. And it was actually one of the first judicial test cases of the enforceability of a Creative Commons license.
In the Netherlands, right?
In the Netherlands, yes.
Yeah.
It was a photo of his children, though. Wasn't it mostly about the fact that it had been his kids being photographed?
It was. I mean, that was another point that they raised in the case, was that, you know, it was just too great an invasion of privacy to go after his child's picture in this way. But of course, he had put it up on Flickr to begin with under that license. So the privacy argument might have a little bit of its legs knocked out from under it. It was really the commercial use part of it that got interesting. And Colette, you and I were taking a look at TwitPic's terms of use, which are an all rights reserved kind of a statement that, you know, we claim no rights in whatever content you put up on TwitPic, and you retain all rights and all rights reserved to you. They do not have a Creative Commons licensing strategy. They barely have a site. I mean, I get the impression that
it's a site held up with duct tape and chewing gum.
Exactly. It seems to me as the most bare of startup kind of organizations, very handy and nice to have around and on the scene, but not, you know, anybody who, it doesn't look like anybody's applied any sort of sophisticated legal analysis to what they're doing. But it does seem to me interesting that, you know, you've got celebrities beginning to go ahead and fill that niche that once they were stocked for. And I could definitely see, you know, a careless tabloid picking up on these things and publishing them and winding up in a similar situation as the Currys had in the Netherlands, getting themselves sued.
One interesting thing I've noticed about celebrities using Twitter is that they often have to come up with, you know, catchy usernames that aren't their actual name. I think Dave Matthews is on Twitter. He's like Dave J. Matthews. I guess Dave Matthews was already taken. I think John Mayer's on too, but he uses his middle name. I forget what it is, but for what that's worth, I have no idea. But.
Right.
Glad I got in there early with Colette.
Amazing, yes.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's another little wrinkle on this is, you know, it's not a domain name, right? It's a subdomain. But it's certainly important to have your own Twitter identity. And right now you have no recourse to ICANN or anything else. You'd have to go to Twitter and say, hey, there's someone fake pretending to be me or squatting on my name, and you need to pry that away from them and give it to me.
Yes.
So.
And you could.
And then you have to take the pic, holding the sign, prove it's you, and
send it to yourself in the mail so that it's postmarked. Exactly.
Right. Well, I mean, I don't know if you guys saw. I did put it in the show notes. There's somebody decided to take a look at the Am Law 100, American Lawyer 100 law firms, and see how many of them had a Twitter presence. And some of them did and were actively using it, a very few. And then some of them had enough foresight to go ahead and at least snap up their name. But, you know, most others had not. And I think that at this juncture, that's probably true of a lot of companies and a lot of individuals who would want to protect that aspect of their persona.
And, you know, I know of at least one law firm, and I'm not going to mention it because I have friends over there, but their domain, you know, the part that comes before the .com has been misappropriated as a Twitter username, and somebody goes and just posts links to articles saying bad things about this law firm. Like, you know, they're laying off all these people, you know, so-and-so's been brought up before the disciplinary commission. So-and-so has been accused of conflict of interest. So yeah, there's definitely an opportunity for some evildoers to drag a name through the dirt, and it's happening.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that there would be a whole lot of recourse for that. As long as what they're publishing is true, you know.
Oh, not in the First Circuit though.
Oh, that's right. We had that case come out, which Bob Ambrogi called the worst defamation decision ever, or most scary, something
dangerous.
Along those lines. Yes, most dangerous. Why don't you go ahead and fill us in on that one, since it is an interesting little wrinkle.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is a case I didn't read. I just read Bob's, you know, summary of it. But from what I gather, it was a case coming out of the First Circuit, you know, the Federal Circuit out east up there where Bob is, essentially holding contrary to the, you know, the well-established Supreme Court precedent, you know, with New York Times versus Sullivan, I believe was the big one that everybody points to, that says that truth is a defense to defamation. I think I'm mischaracterizing New York Times versus Sullivan. I know that has that in there somewhere, but that was more like, you know, the actual malice standard, but it all kind of winds into this. There essentially was a case where a defamation defendant could be found liable, even though the statements that the publisher made were indeed true. And the court held that was, you know, actionable as defamation, even though true, because it was made with ill will. And there were a number of different reasons. I think that, you know, he actually referred to the guy by name. It was an email sent to a bunch of employees. Right.
It was Staples was involved. An email sent to 1,500 employees about the termination of an employee under dubious circumstances.
Right. And
shall we say?
He used the guy's name.
And also said why he was fired, which was allegedly for falsifying travel vouchers or something like that. And they told everyone, including employees that didn't travel, they had never used anyone's name before. And they had never done that type of reporting in a mass email. Like, way more people were involved than necessary was the allegation.
Yeah, so really dragging this guy through the dirt when maybe they didn't need him so much, even though it was true.
Yeah, even though it was wholly true, apparently.
I kind of see the court's point. I mean, I don't know. Is it that wrong? Is it that dangerous?
I don't know. You're getting into the realm of being able to be critical and, you know, really some First Amendment kind of implications. Yeah. Although we're not talking about protecting government speakers or government subjects in this instance.
I would really be interested to know what Colette has to say about this, because I know that she spends a lot of time thinking about reputation, has even brought it up in this call, you know, the value of it and how important it is.
Yeah. It's a great and interesting case. I'm very concerned about it from a First Amendment standpoint, that something that is actually true could be continue to be defamatory. And I understand in this case it's based on a statute, isn't it? Isn't there a statute? Don't they have a statutory
definition?
Yeah, it's 1903 statute. Yeah, 1903.
So maybe their state legislature, among the many things that I'm sure they're doing in Massachusetts, needs to consider, you know, updating the statute to take into account the kind of speech and the forms and methods of speech that we have today. Because that is, I think, a seriously chilling statute when it comes to things that are truth. Because every time, you know, anytime you go to a program where you're talking to people who blog and who are podcasters or doing things like this, and you're giving them sort of the short and sweet summary of defamation law, you almost always hear the clause, which I've said many times, which is, you know, if it's truthful, you will have a defense. You will have a
right. I'm sure it says that in your podcasting legal guide.
Yeah,
it says it in our legal guide. It says it on EFF's website. So it's sort of a common understood basis for you know, advising people who are in media situations about what they should and shouldn't do.
Right.
But, you know, kind of like fair use, it's a right to hire a lawyer and defend yourself. And that's not a great right in some ways. But at least you have this balance with the First Amendment to protect truthful speech, because it is not defamatory to say something that's true. That's sort of the short sweet. This worries me a lot.
I have to say this, Colette. Coming from a journalism background, law and ethics class, my discussion of libel was summarized as don't screw up the facts.
Yeah.
Like, pretty much what that crusty old professor said, don't screw up the facts. I can hear him now.
Yeah.
So,
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and when you get into a realm where, you know, it's something like the Twitter page that has usurped the law firm's domain name and is being critical of the law firm, you know, I actually can think of which one that it is, but it's not coming to the front of my mind right now. I have seen it before and thought it was pretty funny. That you know, that there's a good case to be made that there is a news gathering function for a certain news hungry audience going on there, along the lines of, you know, the same kind of news gathering news function that Above the Law, gossip site has.
But it's still just not fair to all those people at the law firm who have, you know, good you know, work ethic and all this stuff, that their firm is being dragged through the dirt. You know, I mean, it's, you know, like I said, I got friends over there. So it like really ticks me off that somebody's doing that. And it's anyway, but it does kind of raise this larger ethical question. And I don't mean to sound too much like, you know, Jeremy Bentham or something like this, but I'm wondering if holdings like we have from the First Circuit could really at a utilitarian level affect people's conduct. And here's what I'm thinking. You have this notion in the back of your mind that you shouldn't do things that are bad. And you know that if somebody is going to blow the whistle on you, before this First Circuit case or whatever, the general notion, the general theories of defamation law is that they can talk about that and you won't have any recourse against them. Now, is it going to affect people's behavior to say, I can go ahead and fudge a little bit on my expense report, which is what this guy at Staples was, I guess, accused of doing. And if I'm going to get fired for it and, you know, somebody just reports truthfully on that, I can still go ahead and sue them and probably recover. I wonder if it would actually trickle down to the utilitarian level of affecting people's conduct. Jonathan, why don't you see if Ernie's around anywhere down there in New Orleans?
Ernie actually begged off so he could be off drinking hurricanes at this time. So.
Oh, well, if he's drinking, he would.
I think I saw him down in the French Quarter. Well, I don't know where he is. I really don't. But I don't want to get sued for libel.
Right. Well, speaking of having the whistle blown on you against your will and being put in sort of a defensive position, I do want to talk about the whole Facebook terms of service thing that we saw blow up last week. But real quick, I do need to thank our other sponsor, Audible.com. And go ahead and give you this show's Audible recommendation, which is another thing that had me driving happily all over creation during the holidays a couple of months ago and a bit after that, too, because it's a very long work. It is by Neal Stephenson, and it's called Anathem. And it's a great, great book, and I'm sure a lot of people who are loyal Twit listeners have at least heard of it, if not yet picked it up and tried to read it. And I wanted to go ahead and give the Audible recommendation for Anathem because it is a monstrously big book. And it has this whole culture and language that you have to sort of get through at the beginning of the book before you get into the story. And the great thing about having the audio of it is you don't have to do any of the work of kind of slogging through that and figuring out the dates and how to pronounce these words that the very creative author has made up. It's also a very dramatic rendition of the work with a lot of different voices coming into play, both in the narration and in sort of the segues between sections of the books. Neal Stephenson contributes to that part of the effort, and there's great sort of monk music involved and Gregorian chanting going on. So the Audible version of this is definitely worth checking out. If you go to audiblepodcast.com/twill, you'll get your free 14-day trial of the Audible service and a credit for a book. Now, the Anathem book is a $48 purchase from Audible. So I'm not sure if your single credit will get you the whole book. I kind of doubt it, but at least it'll get you part of the way there. And it's a great thing to dive into, and doing the audio actually makes it very entertaining and easy to get through a long work. So go to audiblepodcast.com/twill and let us know what you think of Anathem and if you enjoyed it too. So let's get into the whole Facebook and who owns your data kind of question. And before, against the to provide a bit of context for that, I promised Rick as he got off the phone that we would talk a bit about bloggers' terms of service. And this is a service that sort of predates social networking. And I went in and just took a look to remind myself what those terms of service say about the works that are put into the blogger system by its millions of users. And a blogger takes a very hands-off approach to, unsurprisingly, to what its users' data, how it can be used, and what rights, if any, Blogger has to that data, given that Blogger is just now sort of starting to implement some social communications functions within the system where people can follow each other and have a bit of a community within the system. Now, in contrast, Facebook has always had fairly draconian terms of service, but they just got more so. And Jonathan, since you did a lot of posts on that, why don't you take it and spin out what happened next?
Well, the part of the terms of service that really upset everyone, especially initially, was with Facebook's old TOS, which, by the way, they have now reverted back to. We'll just go ahead and get that out of the way. What there was a clause in it that said that your license to Facebook, and of course, you know, the license to Facebook is very broad, derivative works, licensable, transferable, sublicensable, goes on and on and on. But they had a clause in it that said that your license to Facebook terminates whenever you delete your work from Facebook. So whenever you pull your images down, you delete your post, et cetera, that license terminates. Well, they removed that clause and made the license pretty much perpetual, effectively. And that had a lot of people very worried because, you know, the idea of Facebook can still use their content even when they're no longer members, their account's deleted, and they retired to Acapulco on a beach somewhere, Facebook could be there still using their content. And that caused a tremendous firestorm. It broke out largely over Twitter. It was a post on The Consumerist. I think it was on Sunday that really started it, Sunday of last week. And it broke out in a very big way, and Facebook ended up kind of begging off of it and reverting back to the old TOS. But there were a lot of other changes in there, too, that have been that sort of come to light after the initial consumerist investigation, including a change in venue, so to speak. I believe it moved from Delaware to California, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And some other minor tweaks and changes to it throughout. But now Facebook has actually set up a group to work with users and try to get feedback and talk about what users expect in the terms of service. So they seem to be – I mean, the part of the problem that everyone had with it was kind of a quiet push out of the new terms. It was done with a veil of secrecy, and a lot of people – in fact, no one even realized it had happened until weeks after it had gone live and it had been in effect. So now it seems like they're putting a more public face on it, at least.
Yeah, it really interested me because it's not like this is the first time Facebook has been down this road.
No.
You know, they've certainly stepped in it before in a very public way when it comes to user permissions and privacy and Beacon and all sorts of things. And it just stunned
my good friend Aaron. I can hear Aaron Brazil, my good friend Aaron's yelling, "Beacon sucks," somewhere in the background already.
Right.
So from the last time it happened.
It just stuns me that this could have happened. It also was real interesting to me that it took the spotlight that I think would have been shown on this other news that was announced that Facebook, you know, has opened up its APIs and is the news was generally heralded as very positive. Oh, they're going to be more open. There's going to be more of an opportunity to use Facebook data outside Facebook. But of course, then you get into their whole dynamic privacy issue and the fact that a lot of people using Facebook are putting material there because of this faith they have in the very fine-grained privacy controls that the site permits, and that, you know, how are they going to make that jibe with having more open use of material through various API calls? I don't know. But, you know, anything that would have been trained on that, I think, went over to the terms of service debate and got tied up in there. Does it matter, you guys, that these terms were so overbroad, or does it matter that it was Facebook, or is it both? Because they're certainly not any sort of unique example of overreaching terms of service for big, prestigious websites.
I think FARC had it worst whenever they stepped in it. It came out their terms of service, basically tried to lay claim to all the copyright of everything uploaded through the service, which is, of course, highly unenforceable and creates a whole bunch of other problems. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely the major sites that seem to have the most scrutiny on their TOS.
Well, I think if I could jump in, you know, advising smaller companies than Facebook who are starting up and figuring out what they're doing, I have to say these debacles are really helpful to me as a lawyer, because I can then tell my clients that you think you can just copy and paste someone's terms or copyright policy or privacy policy and move forward. But as soon as you want to amend them or change anything, let's look and see what happens when users start to drill down and how quickly a firestorm can happen. And it has helped me in some way, because I can explain to people how it's important from the very beginning to have a plan for how you want to engage with your community and how you want to go about the process of making changes to policies in the future and embed that in the original policies. And I, in some ways, I'm kind of grateful this happened. I'm grateful the Beacon thing happened, because it really focuses people on these things that a lot of times startups are like rushed to get everything done. They have so many things to get to market, and the legal piece sometimes is sort of lingering. It's like, oh, we can deal with that shortly or soon, or we're good enough.
Sure. And they run out to a law firm who probably isn't that familiar with the site or its overarching policy and the relationship it wants to be having with its users. And they say, give us some terms, and they plunk on some terms.
Yep. They throw in some basic terms that are safe, but not thinking about the community aspect of,
right.
of
and
what's happening.
Colette, when you say safe, that usually means something very conservative and very grabby.
Yep. Absolutely.
Exactly.
It happens. I mean, I've been doing this now on my own for a few years, and I tell you that conversation's a lot easier to have today. Maybe I'm getting better at it, but
well, and I think that lawyers are starting to have the responsibility to have that conversation because, you know, it's, I don't think it's any longer sufficient to throw these quote unquote safe terms at people and say, go forth, you'll be fine, when you're just asking them to open the door to the ire of the interwebs.
Yeah, it's a much more subtle, or I'm sorry, a much more, well, I guess maybe it is subtle. There's the greater risk now to, you know, have a PR mishap. It's not just a legal issue. It's definitely a PR issue. And there's notion of transparency and the feeling that there's a lot of communication on this stuff, and people will be more than happy to develop opinions about something and share that opinions out there, as you say, Denise, on the interwebs.
Yeah. I think, unfortunately, I think there's a big disconnect between, you know, the philosophy and approach that the management of the company wants to take toward its communities and the philosophy and approach of whoever is minding the legal details.
Well, if you'll allow me to comment, if you're bringing up philosophies and approaches on this stuff, I'd like to, you know, make an observation on what I see as kind of a paradox in this whole situation. And I was a guest on Digital Media last Thursday night with John Federico and others, and I kind of just had this notion when I was kind of talking and thinking out loud, and I had this notion, and the paradox is as follows. You know, Facebook was taking a rather expansive approach to the rights that it claims to use its users' intellectual property. You know, and then, you know, we've talked about the contours of what those rights are, and it's essentially a perpetual license even after you delete your account.
And a very broad one to go ahead and make money off of people's content.
Yes, to distribute and display and use it in connection with the advertising.
Derivative works and...
Yes.
Sell it.
There's this, but you know what? It seems like at least, well, maybe all of the commentary out there, well, there's exceptions. Scoble said it wasn't a big deal with it and all that stuff. And there were others that said it's no big deal. But the general outcry or the general sentiment was an outcry. Oh my gosh, how could Facebook, you know, complain? How could they overreach? And I was a voice in that chorus. I wrote a blog post that said, shame on you, Facebook, for overreaching. And, you know, that's the kind of the initial reaction. But let's examine, you know, let's compare that sentiment of outrage with this other sentiment that we, again, have expressed on this call already, of the beautiful things of remix culture, of Creative Commons, putting stuff out there so that the terms are clear, that so that other people can take it and to use it and to make derivative works and to share and to attribute and do all of these things. Why is it that when YouTube talks about enabling Creative Commons, it's like cool and it's the best thing since sliced bread and oh my gosh. But when Facebook gets a license that is actually less restrictive because it's limited to just the advertisement, for example, you know, just in connection with Facebook, and it's just, you know, it's arguably less restrictive. Why is it that we get all upset? Aren't those really aren't really those ambitions one and the same? And shouldn't our reaction to it be one and the same?
I've got two responses to that. First is that Facebook is granting a license to itself, not to, you know, the online community or other users or other people that might, you know, make a thousand flowers bloom in a remix culture kind of way.
Okay, well, in that sense, it's narrower than a Creative Commons license.
True. But it's also less user-driven is my second point. You know, you're burying it in the fine print of terms of service that, you know, people are bound to, even if they don't read, but nobody reads them, and we haven't really, you know, gotten the courts to address that problematic issue, I think, in a sufficient way yet. But, you know, what you're doing is you're upending user expectations. You're breaking the compact with users. And, you know, their choices are pretty limited. I mean, they can pull out of a useful service and try and go elsewhere, or they can just deal with it. And being made to deal with it does not sit well.
Yeah. I see what you're saying.
Well, I have a question along these lines. Maybe someone else can pop on. Why do you think more hosts don't use Creative Commons licensing as part of the terms of service? TalkShoe is a podcast host, and they do. They have their users licensed under a by attribution, non-commercial, share-alike license. Do you think perhaps this would help hosts if they did this? Perhaps it would help with the transparency aspect? Or do you think they're going to just shy away from it and continue with these legalese and confusing licenses?
Well, I think that it would probably serve those hosts' ends, you know, if to do something like that. I think one of Facebook's motivations was to just develop a big data set that's going to inflate its valuation. So if a host were to require all of its users to use a Creative Commons license, that host has thereby obtained the means to have the right to use that content in a certain way in perpetuity. So it, you know, that would serve the end of increasing the size of this data set without it being so draconian and sneaky as what, you know, Mark Zuckerberg and company.
Yeah. Did. I think that's a great kind of solution because it, you know, granted, people are still becoming educated about what Creative Commons licensing means, and there's a lot of confusion out there about it, but at least you're getting closer to making user expectations and the site's expectations jibe with one another.
And that, and like you said, like Denise mentioned, it also is the same license to everyone else, the thousand flowers and all that. Mm-hmm. It works just as well for anyone visiting the site as it does for the site owners.
Right. Yes.
Hey, guys, I have a preschooler I need to go pick up.
Uh-oh.
Otherwise, I would love to stay on with you and chew over these issues further. But I really appreciate your coming on the show. It's been a great time for me, and I'm sure our listeners have enjoyed it as well. I do want to make a plea before I go ahead and sign off, and a pitch, actually, to something I've been enjoying quite a lot, which is if you enjoy this show and if you enjoy Copyright 2.0, Jonathan's show, then you will certainly enjoy the IP Colloquium podcast, which is Professor Doug Lichtman at UCLA has been putting out a series of great, great shows. And one thing that I particularly like about them is that because they are both part of UCLA, I think, and also part of Professor Lichtman's affiliated law firm, they're able to offer MCLE for the shows. And this is something that's always been a goal of mine for TWIL that I've never really tackled because I, you know, although I might be able to jump through all the hurdles to do MCLE in California, we certainly have listeners from, by the way, that stands for Mandatory Continuing Legal Education. And it's something that's important to lawyers because it helps us maintain our licenses and meet our ethical obligations in making sure that we're continuing our training even after law school.
Oh, I think it just keeps us smart.
Yeah, that too. And I think that listening to this show is certainly a smart thing to do. And I would love to give people MCLE credit for doing it. But the administrative hurdles of doing that have been too daunting for me because I'd want to offer it in a number of states if possible. So if there is some well-meaning MCLE accredited in many states person who wants to come along and sponsor TWIL and get, you know, links from our site and our undying thanks and provide the kind of MCLE that the IP Colloquium podcast is offering, I would definitely be willing to chat with you and real anxious to see if we could work something out because I think people would really, really enjoy that little addition to our endeavors here. I'm sure all of the hosts would because we'd all get credit too. And with that, I'd love to thank you guys and hope I can have you all back on the show sometime soon. You can find Jonathan at plagiarismtoday.com and plagiarismtoday on Twitter. Go follow him. Jonathan,
thank you very much, Denise.
Thanks so much for being here. Colette is both Colette and Vogel Law on Twitter. And
yeah, I'm trying in some way to have a private and a non-private, but I don't know if that's going to continue to work.
Well, let us know how that goes.
Yeah, it's been an interesting experiment. But yeah, thank you. It's been really fun chatting today, Denise and Evan and Jonathan and also Rick.
Yes, and Rick, you can find at rickclau.com/tins. He's also rclau, R-K-L-A-U on Twitter. And Evan, thank you so much for returning. And folks can follow you at Internet Cases on Twitter and at internetcases.com.
Yes, it was a pleasure being here. Thank you.
My pleasure, too. You folks can follow me on Twitter at dhowell. And if you go to imetdenise.com, that's something that I recently I'm pointing folks to because it kind of aggregates all my stuff in one place. And it's hard when you have various blogs and podcasts and different things that you're doing. So you can find
that's
it all.
That's a really cool idea.
Yeah. It's something I can credit to Ohio lawyer Matt Buchanan, who found himself in line without a business card at a Cleveland Indians game and told the person, hey, just go to imetmatt.com. And then he went home and hacked something up so that there would actually be something there for them to look at. So great little web tip there for you. Yeah. And we'll see you all next time. Twill is adjourned.